is it Ms. Figueroa?
Ms. Figueroa, yes.
Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name's Melissa Figueroa, senior certified law clerk, here for the appellant, Mr. Gary Mann. There are several issues we have appealed, we have brought forth on this appeal. To start, I would like to cover two broad issues, and those are related to Mr. Gary Mann's jury instructions, as well as the ineffective assistance he received at trial. To start with the jury instructions, the trial court committed error by refusing to allow instructions supplying a missing element of the crime of possession of a stolen firearm.
Now, you say missing element.
Yes, sir.
That's not the way that the appellant's brief was originally argued, was, or maybe it was, but let's jump to the state's brief suggests that the last clause of the statute that creates this offense, the unless clause, is a material element of the offense. The appellant did not file a reply brief, and I would like to know what is the appellant's position about whether the unless clause creates a material element of the offense.
Yes, Your Honor. So our brief does categorize the language as an affirmative defense, as did the trial counsel, the state, and the trial court. But today, we're fully adopting the state's position that this is a missing element of a crime.
And what significance does that have to where does that take us?
In what sense, Your Honor?
Well, what's the result of the case? If it was a material element, how does that affect the case?
Well, the jury instructions are incomplete. They should have included this additional element of the case, especially because it was a core part of Mr. Gary Mann's defense.
Doesn't it raise a potential due process problem if the jury isn't instructed on all of the material elements of the offense? What guarantee do we have that they found all the material elements of the offense beyond a reasonable doubt?
Yes, that is what So going back to the standard of jury instructions, as this court knows, it is a matter of law, therefore they are reviewed independently of the trial court's decision. Jury instructions are to be read together, correctly stating the law, they must not be misleading, and they also must adequately cover the issues supported by the pleadings and evidence. To reverse the conviction on jury instructions, the jury instructions must, again, be a correct statement of the law, there must be evidence to support the jury instructions, and the defendant, Mr. Gary Mann, must have been prejudiced by the lack of instruction. Jury instruction number 3 in this case failed to include the language unless the firearm is possessed, received, retained, or disposed of with intent to restore it to the owner. This language is provided by statute, should have been included as an element of the crime.
So are you asking then, did your client get a new trial?
Yes, Your Honor. There's evidence to support this. This jury instruction should have been submitted. Mr. Mann testified that it was his intent that the firearm would be returned to his brother. Additionally, as a result of the lack of this jury instruction, Mr. Mann was prejudiced at the trial. This incomplete jury instruction is a missing element that spoke to the core of his defense. Without this legal framework for the jury was missing core information
The state's position is that other portions of the instructions essentially required the jury to find the missing element, even if not specifically instructed thereon. What's your response to that argument, specifically the use of the word, the definition of stolen and the use of the term deprived?
We disagree with that argument, Your Honor. The jury is not expected to know the definition of deprived. Deprived is ambiguous and has been defined by Nebraska statute. Chapter 28, section 501, subsection 1 defines deprived as to withhold property of another permanently or for so extended a period of time as to appropriate a major portion of its economic value or with intent to restore only upon payment of reward or compensation, or B, to dispose of property of another is to create a substantial risk that the owner will not recover it in the condition it was when the actor obtained it.
Does the definition in 28501 that you quote, does that section limit the definition to for purposes of this chapter or for purposes of this article? In other words, we're now talking, that's 28500, which is the theft statutes, but we're not in 28500 and something. We're in 28 1212.03. Is it clear from the statutory language, and I'm asking for help here because I don't know the answer, does the definition, is it by its terms restricted, or does it apply throughout the criminal code?
The statute does make a comment that the definition of deprive is applicable to sections 509 through 518, which would apply to the theft.
Not to the statute that's in front of us.
Right.
So what effect does that have?
I think the fact that the Nebraska legislator did define the word deprive speaks as to its ambiguity. I'm not necessarily saying that it should have used this definition specifically, but it should have been defined in one way or another through the jury instructions.
Is the problem a lack of a definition, or is the problem a failure to instruct the jury on all the elements?
I separated them as two separate issues. So both the missing element of the unless language as well as the failure to define the word deprive.
But now I'm confused. The unless language applies to a crime that's not on deck, so why would we include it? Or did I mishear you?
Can you repeat the question? Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
You say that the unless language applies to?
The unless language applies to the possession of a stolen firearm crime. So that would be the missing element that we sought to have a jury instruction for.
In a case where possession is charged.
Right.
Did the defendant ask for an instruction defining the word deprive?
The trial counsel for the defendant did not. So if this court does not agree that there was plain error for failure to define the word deprive, that the trial counsel's failure to request this jury instruction would speak to as his ineffectiveness of counsel at the trial level. So transitioning into my ineffective assistance of counsel argument, as this court knows, that question is a mixed question of law and fact. The review for factual finding is clear error, while the question of counsel's performance and prejudice to the defendant is de novo review. This is a two-pronged analysis where the defendant bears the burden to prove that the trial counsel's performance was not equal to that a lawyer with ordinary training and skill in the area, as well as there's reasonable probability that but for the counsel's deficient performance, the result of the proceeding would have been different. Although trial counsel did briefly discuss the word deprive in his closing arguments is not evidence. And so without this proper, without an actual jury instruction, the jury did not have the legal framework to base their decision as to Mr. Mann's guilt. Additionally, and probably most egregiously, trial counsel's failure to object to prejudicial testimony regarding Mr. Mann invoking his Fourth Amendment right was also an issue at the trial. As this court knows, individuals are constitutionally protected from unreasonable searches and seizures, and this right to refuse to consent to a search does not trigger probable cause for a search.
We have lots of jurisprudence about a Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination, that the state can't use that as evidence. Do you have any case law for applicable to using the Fourth Amendment in that context?
For the right, just to make sure that I understand your question correctly.
Well, the question, did he consent to the search, that's the constitutional argument is premised on the Fourth Amendment. The case law that I'm familiar with about did he make an admission or did he stand mute, that's a Fifth Amendment, and there's a reason why that jurisprudence says that can't be brought up. Is there equivalent jurisprudence on the Fourth Amendment being brought up in front of a jury? And if so, what is it?
In front of a jury, I don't have that, Your Honor.
All
I don't
right,
know
thank
if there
you.
Is.
Does your brief, you? I understood you to argue that trial counsel was ineffective for not requesting a definition of deprive Is that something that's argued in your brief?
Yes, that trial counsel was ineffective for failing to...
For failing to request a definition.
To request that, yes, that is argued in the brief. The state began their opening statements at trial, emphasizing twice that Mr. Mann denied consent to law enforcement. Again, while it is true that opening statements are not evidence, the state continued this trend of purposefully bringing up the fact that Mr. Mann did deny consent to law enforcement. The state's sole purpose in this questioning was to imply guilt in front of the jury, so that he may seem guilty, basically, for invoking this Fourth Amendment constitutional right to refuse to consent to a search. There's nothing wrong in invoking constitutional right. Your Honor, I see that I am out of time. So with that, I will conclude. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Vincent, good morning to you.
May it please the court, my name is Melissa Vincent. I'm an assistant attorney general and I represent the appellee, the state of Nebraska. Mann has alleged four assignments of error, but I intend to address only two, the improper exclusion of testimony, or the improperly excluded testimony and the jury instructions. Mann first claims the district court erred by refusing to allow him to question Barnes about his use of speed and whether it affected his memory. I disagree for the reasons stated in my brief, and although I stand by those reasons, I don't believe we need to delve too deeply into this alleged error, because assuming it was error, it was undoubtedly harmless for two reasons. First, although Mann was not allowed to question Barnes about his use of speed, he was allowed to question him about his use of Xanax, and he got him to admit that sometimes he overused it and it could have affected his memory. Consequently, Mann was able to argue that theory to the jury, and in fact did. Second, perhaps more importantly, Mann admitted on cross-examination that he did not have permission to take the gun on the date of the offense. That admission, of course, is fatal to his claim. Any error here was harmless. That brings me to the jury instructions. I don't see any problems with the definitions, so unless the court has questions, I do not intend to address them. Instead, I will focus on whether the district court properly instructed the jury regarding the elements of the offense. Statute at issue here is section 28-1212.03, which provides in pertinent part that any person who possesses a stolen firearm, knowing or believing that it has been stolen, shall be guilty of a Class 2A felony unless the firearm is possessed with intent to restore it to the owner. While both parties and the district court characterized the intent to restore language as an affirmative defense, I question whether that's correct based on my review of the statute and this court's decision in Hubbard, which involved a different but analogous statute. I believe it's more properly characterized as an element. Assuming that's correct, the question then becomes whether the jury was properly instructed on the elements of the offense. I submit the answer is yes, because although the element instruction does not include the intent to restore language, it did require the jury to find that the firearm was stolen, meaning it was taken without permission or authority with intent to deprive, and as this court recognized in Hubbard, the term deprive encompasses a lack of intent to restore the property to its owner.
Hubbard was not a jury instructions case, though, was it?
No. No, it didn't involve jury instructions.
Does that matter?
I don't believe so.
Why not?
Because, first of all, they were talking about, in that case, they raised a question regarding the sufficiency of the information and whether that language encompassed or apprised the defendant of the elements of the offense. And they found that, yeah, deprived, just the meaning of deprived generally, encompasses this lack of intent to restore. So I don't see any difference between what happened here and there, because I think it boils down to what is the commonly understood meaning of deprived. And I think that permanent withholding is probably correct.
Now, the information here didn't allege the unless clause at all, did it?
No, it did not.
And the information doesn't use the word deprive at all either.
No, it didn't, but the information hasn't been challenged here. And beyond that, I think the question is, you know, you have to look at whether the defendant was prejudiced by it. I mean, obviously, the information sets forth a general description of the offense. It also includes a reference to the statute. It's clear from the record that the defendant knew what he'd been charged with. It is a legitimate crime. He knew exactly what it was that the statute required. There was a discussion about this before trial. The evidence was adduced at trial. It was argued. This issue has been fully litigated. So while it's not in the information, I don't see any reason to question its validity.
There's a whole bunch of folks who need to know what's going on, and even if the defendant knew what was going on, did the jury know what was going on? Would the defendant's proposed instruction number 3 have been useful, even though at that point in time folks were talking about affirmative defense?
Well, I suppose it may have, but I mean, that's the standard that we use when we're reviewing jury instructions, because even in Merchant, you know, like, which was a case from 2014, this court said that that's not structural error, that if you don't submit an element to the jury, that's not necessarily reversible. We review it for harmless error. So we look at the jury instructions as a whole, and if you have to first find that the firearm is stolen, and that requires that it be taken without permission or authority with the intent to deprive, and the commonly understood meaning of deprived is to permanently withhold, then I think the jury instructions read as a whole do adequately cover that.
Is that the commonly understood meaning? I mean, is it conceivable that you could, as the term is used, deprive someone of something with the intent to give it back? I take your car for a day and I have every intent to give it back to you at the end of the day, but isn't it possible to say I've deprived you of that for a day?
I suppose it's possible, but I don't think within the context that it's being used here that that's really a reasonable definition of the term. I mean, it is a stolen, and the term stolen itself implies that you have taken something with the intent not to return it. I mean, that's you know, you have to look at it within the context of the offense that has been alleged here. And so when you're using the term stolen and deprive in the same context, I think the natural inclination is to think, well, this person has taken it and doesn't intend to return it.
Wasn't there evidence that the defendant at least made a text message indicating an intent to restore the stolen item?
What he said was, I'm sorry, I took your gun. You probably won't get it back for a while. That's what he said. And that, I guess, gets me down to my second part, was if the court disagrees with me that this is an element and it was actually an affirmative defense, I would submit to you that it was the district court correctly refused to give that instruction because it wasn't supported by the evidence.
If we do agree with you that it was an element, I'm still back on the information. We have a lot of case law that says failure to charge a crime, if you don't charge the elements, you haven't charged a crime. That can be raised at any time, and indeed it's a matter of plain error, isn't it?
That's true, but there is conflicting case law on that, I would point out. I mean, there have been cases out of this court in particular where an element has been omitted, and the court said, well, it generally describes the crime, and it specifically references the statute under which he was charged, and so that necessarily pulls in these elements sets forth the elements. And then, of course, you have to look at whether there was any actual prejudice, because to me it seems silly that we're going to stand here and say, okay, well, we've gone through this trial, everybody's on the same page, the intent to restore was an element, it's been fully litigated, the jury rejected the theory, and now all of a sudden we're going to question whether he had, you know, because my understanding of the pleading requirement is that it's grounded in due process, which means you have to give them notice of what they've been charged with so that they can prepare their defense. Well, that happened here. We know that he knows exactly what was on the table here, and it was fully litigated, and so now I see no point to question it at this time. And there is the one proposition in Peterson v. Houston that says that no information shall be deemed invalid for any defect or imperfection which does not prejudice the substantial rights of the defendant on the merits. And so I would submit to you that the information in this case performed or functioned as it was intended, and so I don't see any reversible error there.
Is that because of the way that the proceedings rolled out, as opposed to if you look at it as of the moment that it was filed? Are you arguing that the information was sufficient to charge all of the elements of the offense as of the date it was filed, or you're arguing there's no prejudice because as things rolled out, the missing element in the information was actually addressed?
Well, it was actually addressed. I mean, the information says what it says, and I have a magic wand. I can't go back and change that. So, I mean, it's as written, it says what it says.
But there's doesn't have the unless.
It doesn't have the extra element in it, no. But again, that was addressed. And there's case law, too, suggesting that you can amend an information at any time prior to the verdict.
Right.
So we could have gotten all the way through the trial in this case. The state could have rested, and this actually happened in one case where they got all the way through it. State rested. Defendant moves to dismiss the case based on this defect in the information because it fails to allege an element. State moves to amend, district court granted it, it goes up on appeal, and it's affirmed because of that particular proposition. And they look at it and say, well, you know what, there was no prejudice to you anyway because all of this was taken care of during these actual proceedings.
But here the difference is there was no amendment.
Right, there was no amendment, but functionally, what's the difference? if I can amend it after we've already gone through the trial, and you should have prepared your defense, and that's okay.
Can you amend it now?
I doubt it.
Isn't it also true that in this case, there was no instruction to the jury to consider that material element?
That's true, but as I said in Merchant, it's not structural error if you don't submit a particular or essential element to the offense. We still review it for harmless error.
That goes back to my question. I think there's a couple of audiences, and what the information is designed to do serves a different function than what the jury instructions are designed to do.
Right.
And unless language seems to be have been omitted in both cases. Is that interesting? Is that significant?
Well, I don't think so, because again, I still think that the information in this case did perform the function that it's intended to. It did provide him notice. That is an actual offense. He knew what the statute required, and that was fully litigated at trial. And then, of course, we get to the jury instructions, which you have to read as a whole, and then the question, I guess, boils down to whether the term deprived or deprive actually encompasses that element, as this court found in Hubbard, or if it means something else in this particular context. I submit to you that it doesn't, but ultimately you will decide whether that's the case. But as far as the affirmative defense, as I was answering Justice Frydenberg's question, I submit that it wasn't supported by the evidence. Mann testified that he intended to commit suicide and that he merely assumed that the state would return the gun to Barnes. That assumption, however, does not equate to an intent to restore, which implies a present ability to control disposition of the property. Obviously, if Mann intended to kill himself, he would have had no ability to effectuate his intent. So, in short, I see no reversible error here. So, unless there are additional questions, I would ask the court to adjourn, affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for